Ladies and gentlemen, we present at this time the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Ladies and gentlemen, from Father Coughlin and his associates. Today, the Reverend Dr. Edward Lodge Curran and Father Coughlin will address you. Both these addresses are available in printed form to all who request a copy directly from Father Coughlin. First, Father Curran will come to the microphone. Following him, you will hear the voice of Father Coughlin. And now may I present Father Curran in his address entitled, The Challenge of the Pact and the Challenge of Social Justice.
On Friday night, August the 25th, it was my happy privilege to address one of the most enthusiastic and inspiring social justice mass meetings ever held in this country. Over 3,500 people crowded into the music hall of the city of Cincinnati, a city whose civic pride and whose historical contributions to our common Americanism are second to none in the municipal life of America. For 2 hours and a half, the rafters rang with American applause as speaker after speaker contributed some new thought or painted some new idealism in the unfolded panorama of social justice. At the close of the meeting, every member of the audience went forth, inspired by the voice of Father Coughlin himself across the wires, and determined that the magazine Social Justice shall become the most widely read publication throughout this queen city on the banks of the Ohio. Every effort to stop the meeting was made by the leftist forces who claim the right to freedom of speech for themselves, but who deny it to others. 72 hours before the meeting, all the efforts of the splendid Cincinnati committee and sponsors had almost dwindled to idle gestures. A Mr. Van Schlichter, a teacher in one of the Cincinnati schools, had accepted the invitation to act as chairman. Mr. Henry Siegel, editor of the American Israelite, promptly complained to the school board. The school board held a secret meeting, and at that meeting, the pedagogical wisdom of withdrawing as chairman was impressed quite concretely upon Mr. von Schlichter. And Mr. von Schlichter, in free, democratic, 20th century America, was forced to withdraw. This is the same Cincinnati school board which has permitted the communists to make use of Woodward High School. This is the same Cincinnati school board which has never presumed to reprimand any of its other employees who have participated in the activities of the communistically blinded and communistically controlled American League for Peace and Democracy. What a travesty upon American democracy. What an insult to the citizens of Cincinnati. The Cincinnati School Board can tolerate the invasion of its school system and the occupation of its school buildings by any radical or crackpot or red dedicated to the overthrow of our American government. But it could not tolerate the invitation to be chairman of an American meeting sent to Mr. von Schlichter by American citizens who have dedicated themselves to the cause of social justice and to the preservation of democracy throughout the United States of America. In this tyrannical and un-American pressure, the Cincinnati School Board betrayed all the earmarks of communistic dictatorship. The Cincinnati School Board persuaded Mr. von Schlichter to resign as chairman during the period of Mr. von Schlichter's vacation, and therefore at a time when the board possessed no jurisdiction over his activities. The citizens of Cincinnati have already come to the dawn of totalitarianism in America. If the editor of the American Israelite has the power to compel the school board to take notice of a matter that is none of the board's business. The citizens of Cincinnati are already subjected to dictatorship. If the school board can successfully overreach its authority in forbidding Mr. von Schlichten to exercise his American constitutional right of freedom of assemblage, which involves the right of Mr. von Schlichten to assemble himself wherever he desires. The O Gay Pay U activities of Mr. Siegel and the Cincinnati School Board deserve the strongest reprimand that the free people of Cincinnati can give them. Despite the meddling of Mr. Siegel and the Cincinnati School Board, the meeting was a success. Despite the pressure from other surreptitious sources, which resulted in forcing several speakers to withdraw their previous acceptances to speak, the meeting was a success. It was a success because the people of Cincinnati are Americans in thought and outlook and feeling and determination. It was a success because the cause of social justice is an American cause, the only American cause that should occupy the attention of the American people and their elected officials today. It was a success because the cause of social justice is the cause of democracy, the cause of humanity, and the cause of God. No matter what opposition may arise against the mass meetings and the activities of social justice groups in other cities and in other states, this story of the Cincinnati mass meeting must never be forgotten. Unity and determination can overcome all obstacles. The principles of social justice flow from the life-giving reality and the life-giving symbol of the cross. And in the sign of the cross, the cross of Christ, we believers in social justice shall always conquer. The movement of social justice to which we are dedicated is part and parcel of the Christian heritage of the past 1900 years. The primary doctrine of social justice is the infinite value and infinite dignity of every human being born into this world. Man is not a machine. Labor is not a commodity. The spirit is superior to the flesh. This is the teaching of Christ. And this was the challenge thrown by the early Christians at the pagan totalitarianism of ancient Rome. The entire history, as well as the entire teaching of Christianity, is associated with the movement of social justice. The first labor unions in the history of the world were the medieval guilds of the ages of Christian faith. What was the purpose of these medieval unions? Their purpose was economic as well as spiritual, sociological as well as social. They existed to secure higher wages, fewer working hours, better living and working conditions for the workers of the world. And no history of those medieval ages of faith can be written by any impartial and objective historian today without the admission that in every phase of life, the workers in the Middle Ages were happier and better, more prosperous and more contented than the workers of the modern world, which began its economic tyranny when the guilds were swept away by modern paganism. No critic of our modern depression can fail to trace its root causes to the 19th century. The 19th century was the century of finance capitalism. The 19th century was the century of consecrated and gigantic usury. The 19th century was the century of child labor and degraded womanhood. The 19th century was the century of starvation wages. The 19th century was the century which forbade working men to resurrect the medieval guilds and to organize unions for their economic betterment. In England, every such attempted organization was stigmatized as a conspiracy against the state. Helpless workers, striving to unite for their mutual economic betterment, ran foul of the British common law definition of conspiracy. The 19th century was the century of the Industrial Revolution, with its gilded yachts and vermin-covered huts, with its factories and slums, with its human wreckage and its inhuman indifference to worldwide suffering. And throughout that 19th century, may I ask whose voice it was that shouted the primeval call across the darkness, saying, "Let there be light, the light of Christian justice and charity to dissolve the pagan darkness of avarice and greed." Throughout the 19th century, whose voice was it that denounced child labor, that protested the degradation of women outside the home, that called for a living wage, that excoriated the newer and more blasphemous forms of usury that had arisen, that declared the British common law definition of conspiracy to the contrary notwithstanding, the workers of the world have not merely the right, they have the duty to organize for the protection of their economic rights. It was not the voice of a professional economist. It was not the voice of a political parrot. It was the voice of a great leader of Christianity. May 15th, 1891, the encyclical on the condition of labor, Pope Leo XIII. And 2 years before the New Deal was ever born, whose voice was it that reiterated and reallocated and reemphasized the great labor charter of his predecessor? Whose voice was it that once again shouted the primeval call across the darkness, saying, "Let there be light, the light of Christian justice and charity to dissolve the pagan darkness of avarice and greed"? It was not the voice of a professional economist. It was not the voice of a political parrot. It was the voice of a great leader of Christianity. May 15th, 1931, the encyclical on the reconstruction of the social order, His Recent Holiness, Pope Pius XI, of happy memory. And for the past 13 years, whose voice was it that has kept propagating the message of Christian social justice across the airways of America? Whose voice was it that took the principles of the two great papal encyclicals and translated them into the language of the common people, so that the poorest sharecropper in the South and the most abandoned industrial worker along the city streets could understand their meaning? Whose voice was it that called for an abandonment of war, for the payment of a living annual wage, for the wider extension of private property, for the abolition of child labor, for greater social happiness and larger economic opportunity in this land of bungled abundance? Whose voice was it that once again shouted the primeval call across the darkness, saying, "Let there be light, the light of Christian justice and charity to dissolve the pagan darkness of avarice and greed"? It was not the voice of a professional economist. The voices of professional economists did not carry beyond the confines of their classrooms. It was not the voice of a political parrot. The voices of political parrots are attuned to personal aggrandizement and to dynastic power. For the past 13 years, in strictest harmony with his Christian heritage of 1900 years gone by, it was the voice of Father Coughlin, the leader of the only social justice movement that can save these United States of America from the pain and the poverty of the modern paganism that is upon us. There never was a time when the union of all forces that believe in social justice was so imperative as now. The twilight of Christianity means the twilight of social justice. The death of Christianity would mean the death of social justice. For 1900 years, the march of Christian social justice has been away from the marshlands of pagan lust and the quicklime of pagan power. Modern paganism would frighten Christian social justice into a retreat, back to the marshlands of pagan lust, and back to the quicklime of pagan power. Modern paganism would exterminate the very memory of Christ from the minds of men. In this, the paganism of Nazi Germany and the paganism of Soviet Russia are identical. We must not permit the march of Christian social justice to be interrupted. We must not permit the cause of Christian social justice to die. We must not permit the ideals of Christian social justice to be extinguished in the conflagration of modern paganism all around us. The ideals and ideas of Christian social justice are not limited to any race, to any color, to any religion. Christian social justice is for Jews as well as for Christians, for Protestants as well as for Catholics, and even for atheists as well as for believers. If certain Protestant groups will not accept Christ as God, they can at least accept his spiritual leadership and the social justice principles by which the pagan Roman world was once transformed because he came. If the Jews will not accept the divinity of Christ, they can remember that in flesh and blood he belonged to them, and they can accept him as a prophet of social justice. This is the heart and soul of the social justice movement which we espouse. Social justice for all under the spiritual leadership of Christ. The battle of Armageddon is coming nearer. Satan and Beelzebub have signed a pact. The nasty Stalin alliance has awakened the world to the gigantic structure of the modern paganism that would destroy us. The shadow of pagan Russia lies heavy today upon Asia. The shadow of pagan Germany lies heavy today upon Europe. We who believe in social justice have never paid tribute or given praise to either. We who believe in social justice have branded them both for what they are and for what the nasty Stalin Pact has revealed them before all the world to be: twin monsters, drunk with power, and dedicated to the destruction of religion and the enslavement of humanity throughout the world. We who believe in social justice have never given encouragement to the penetration of American society by the minions of pagan communism or pagan Nazism. We who believe in social justice need not apologize for our attitude on either the internal or foreign policy which should be pursued by the government elected by American votes and paid for out of American taxes in Washington. We who believe in social justice have warned the American people against any international flirtation with Soviet Russia, the international card shark who gave aces to Hitler and jacks to England and to France. We who believe in social justice have warned the President of the United States to follow in the footsteps of Washington and not in the footsteps of Wilson. The announcement of the nasty Stalin Pact caused no consternation or embarrassment in our ranks. It was foretold by Father Coughlin in the columns of Social Justice Magazine months and months ago. To all the editors in the United States of America, Father Coughlin can say, if he wants to say, ladies and gentlemen, I told you so. We who believe in social justice owe no apology for our attitude on foreign affairs to the American public that is just realizing how far along the pathway of deceit and ignorance the foreign policy of our country has taken them. There are no red faces among the followers of social justice or the readers of Social Justice Magazine. There are red faces, as well as red mentalities, among the followers of Earl Browder and the readers of the Daily Worker. In view of the nasty Stalin Pact, what are the communists of New York City going to do for a parade? The Pact of Comrade Stalin has made all Stop Hitler parades a thing of the deceitful past. The only parades Comrade Stalin will permit are Putsch Hitler parades. On what theme is the presidential campaign of the communists in 1940 to be conducted? The communists can no longer howl their incantations against Hitler and Nazism. They may even be forced to run Browder for president and Fritz Kuhn for vice president. They may even be forced to add the swastika to the hammer and sickle at the masthead of the Daily Worker. They may even be forced to mingle the strains of the horse vessel with the strains of the Internationale. Poor communists of New York. There they lie with the sign of the swastika above them. Poor communists of New York. There they march, clenched fists in rhythm with the Nazi goose step. Poor communists of New York. There they cower, afraid lest the old gay PayU agents of Stalin in America arrest them and punish them for the tons of anti-Nazi literature spewed forth from their red inkwells. No wonder the Daily Worker is silent. No wonder Earl Browder is tongue-tied. No wonder his oratory is stale. No wonder American Jews are outraged by Stalin's condonation of the crimes of Hitler against the Jews. No wonder all American communists stand repudiated before the bar of American democracy and before the tribunal of social justice. No more. Oh, nevermore shall the pavement of Union Square resound with red, swashbuckling denunciation of Nazism. No more, oh, nevermore shall the trench fist be raised against Hitler. No more, oh, nevermore shall the war cry be sounded against Germany by Browder or Foster or Budenz or Amster. No more, never more, shall red feet dance the daily picket around the German consulate in New York. Comrade Stalin embraces Führer Hitler, and the American communists have a Nazi uncle to obey. There are no red faces among the followers of social justice or the readers of Social Justice magazine. There are red faces as well as red mentalities among the communist fellow travelers and the self-styled liberals in these United States of America. Who can ever forget the barrage of words and the shrapnel of paragraphs and the tanks of poisonous gas with which the Berlin-Rome Axis was greeted and pestered by the liberal professors and the liberal news commentators and the liberal editors of America? Where now, liberal slaves and slavish liberals? Where now is your barrage of words and your shrapnel of paragraphs and your tanks of poisonous gas before the advance of the nasty Stalin pact across the world? Where is all your fine idealism, all your crimson words of holy thought, all your denunciation of Germany and of any country or group or individual that dared be seen in her company? Are you fair, or have you been paid with Moscow gold? Are you courageous, or are you cowards? Are you Americans, or are you communists? What is the Dorothy Thompson Kaltenborn Brigade going to do without the nasty scapegoat on which to drape all the international ills of the world? Stalin has condoned the rape of Czechoslovakia. Does the Thompson Kaltenborn Brigade do likewise? Stalin has condoned the Nazi persecution of the Jews. Does the Thompson Kaltenborn Brigade do likewise? Stalin has abandoned Poland into the arms of Germany. Does the Thompson Kaltenborn Brigade do likewise? Stalin has opened the wheat fields and the oil wells of Russia to Nazi Germany in her march towards power. Does the Thompson Kaltenborn Brigade approve? What have the Thompson Kaltenborn Brigade and all the leftist news commentators throughout America to say about the nasty Stalin pact? If they are fair and courageous and American, they will unite in a denunciation of this unholy alliance. If they are fair and courageous and American, they will denounce the godlessness of communistic philosophy, the tyranny of Stalin, and the diabolical duplicity with which the Pontius Pilate of Russia made friends with the Herod of Germany for the crucifixion of civilization and Christianity throughout the world. We who believe in social justice know not what others may do in the light of recent international events. We know not if the fake liberals of America are going to hang their heads in shame as they should do and apologize for trying to deceive the American people into the belief that communist Russia is a democracy. We know not whether American communists, incensed by the fact that Stalin has made them the laughing stock of America, are going to desert to Trotsky, who waits in Mexico for the red letter day of revolution in the United States, or are going to repudiate the party and the pagan philosophy of communism which betrayed us. We know not if the President of the United States is finally convinced of the truth presented week after week in social justice and warning the government against its blushing flirtation with Soviet Russia. We know not if the president realizes that in this nasty Stalin pact is contained the baleful reward for his recognition of Soviet Russia 9 years ago and the communist ridicule for his Nazi baiting and fascist baiting at the expense of the foreign trade of America. We know not what others may do, but we know full well what we must do and what we shall do for the cause of social justice and for the preservation of our American democracy. We shall continue to speak and write and work for the things which we Americans hold dear. We shall continue to point out the gathering storm of paganism, rendered more imminent and more powerful by the conjunction of German stormtroops and communistic Cossacks in one terrifying army of pagan totalitarianism. We shall warn the American government to cease making friends of the mammon of communist iniquity. We shall battle the forces of Nazism as well as the forces of communism in this country. We shall call upon all Americans, Catholic and Protestant and Jew, to unite lest the nasty Stalin pact be extended to our own country. We shall call upon all American communists to repudiate communism and to return to the ranks of Americanism. We shall call upon all American Nazis to repudiate Nazism and to return to the ranks of Americanism. American communists have been abandoned by Soviet Russia. American Nazis have been abandoned by Nazi Germany. The United States is willing to forgive and forget if only those who are communists will become again Americans, and if only those who are Nazis will become again Americans. There is no room for any politicalism in this country except Americanism. For years, this message has gone forth from the airways and the platforms devoted to social justice. This message rings truer today than it ever did before. In the pages of Social Justice magazine and over the airways from Royal Oak, Father Coughlin has prophesied the international events that shock the sanity and the morality of the world today. The nasty Stalin pact is a challenge to the world, a challenge of the older paganism that would destroy social justice, and a challenge of the older internationalism that would destroy Americanism. Come back to the ideology of American democracy. Accept the ideology of Christian social justice. This is the call which we who believe in democracy and social justice issue today to every American citizen, Catholic and Protestant and Jew alike.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you Father Coughlin in his address, What of the Future?
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, in your name and in my own, I sincerely thank our mutual friend, the scholarly Dr. Edward Lodge Curran, president of the International Catholic Truth Society, for his timely, inspiring, and informative address. Dr. Curran always will be welcome to appear on this program and to join this network from Brooklyn. His message always will be helpful, and his cooperation with us in the cause of social justice always will be regarded as most beneficial. Dr. Curran referred to several news items in the past issues of Social Justice magazine, in which was predicted as early as last April the wedding of the two monstrosities, red and brown Bolshevism, which now threaten to dominate. For Europe and its millions of innocent inhabitants, we entertain nothing but the deepest sympathy. We sympathize with the downtrodden people of Russia. We sympathize with the crushed people of Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia. And as for Christian Poland, the entire world may well weep as it envisions a new era of persecution from without and anguish from within for that valiant nation. What thoughts occupy our minds in the midst of all this turmoil? Are we thinking of the world war with its carnage, its corpses, and its subsequent decay of cherished ideals? Are we mindful of the unjust exactions born from the Treaty of Versailles? Are we concerned with the causes which produced a Lenin, a Trotsky, and a Stalin? And do we dwell upon the events which preceded the rapid rise to power of a Hitler? Sober minds are interested, more so now than ever, with the answer to these historic questions. And sober minds, arranging them together in a logical chain, are asking themselves, what means all this to America? What means all this to civilization? And what means all this to Christianity? I believe that I am in safe ground in affirming that the world war was fought for commercial domination and not for the preservation of democracy. I believe that I am on the side of truth when I say that the peace treaty of Versailles was nothing more than a document of hatred devised in a mad attempt to preserve the evils of international capitalism. And I believe that although the communism of Russia was in part a rebellion against the system of international capitalism, nevertheless, it was an insane rebellion because it fought not only the persecutors of the poor, but the principles of right reason and the outraged Christ who loves the poor. Call it a rebellion, a revolution, if you will. Describe it as an offensive mechanism against capitalism, if you choose. Oh, but do not fail to credit communism with the destruction of millions of innocent victims, the abolition of private property, and the cancellation of untold personal, religious, and political liberty. And as for Nazism, explain that too as a defense mechanism against communism, which had invaded Germany, but also estimate that it was a destroyer of personal, religious, and political liberty. Do not forget that, like communism, the National Socialism of Germany was opposed to international capitalism, which was so responsible for the World War and for the subsequent peace treaty of Versailles. Communism and Nazism, while apparently poles apart, were in reality satanic twins of destruction. Although the leaders of these heinous systems proclaimed that their objectives aimed at social and economic reforms, nevertheless, because they rebelled against God and right reason, they will produce nothing but ruin and devastation. Now these two abominations have pledged their mutual support. Now the forces of anti-God and anti-Christ have consolidated. Well may a shocked world ask itself, what of the future of Christianity? Well may Europe inquire, what of the future of Western civilization? And well may America pause as it speculates, what of the future of these United States? My friends, I am not prepared to admit that the causes of communism and Nazism were totally economic and totally the result of the abuses practiced in the name of capitalism. As Dr. Curran pointed out to you, men in charge of the destinies of European nations since the 15th century had conspired against the social doctrines of Jesus Christ. Social doctrines which the Divine Master had promulgated for the peace and prosperity of the human race. All these men opposed the guild system under which workmen, tradesmen, and artists were bound together by religious and economic ties. These men instituted a policy of class conflict and opposed the Christian policy of class cooperation. These men reestablished the materialistic concept of life and abandoned the doctrine of the mystical body of Christ. Pagan usury was readopted. Pagan individualism was reaccepted, while kings and parliaments, philosophers and economists, yes, even some churchmen, scorned the teaching that whatsoever we do unto the least of Christ's little ones, we do unto him. Yes, most certainly, the evils which befell the world prior to the advent of communism and Nazism are definitely traceable to man's infidelity to God and to his rejection of the gospel of his only begotten Son. And as a result of this betrayal against God and his Christ, miseries multiplied, poverty increased, and desolation became widespread. Eventually came the great revolution known as the French Revolution. Off fell the heads of the Bourbons who had procrastinated with the evils of their time. Up arose the radical pagans proclaiming the rights of man and disclaiming the rights of God, of whom their former rulers had made a mockery. And how inconsequential are man's rights when God's rights are denied? For what lasting benefits, I ask you, did this rebellion achieve? Following the French Revolution, there soon came the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. New inventions demanded new economies. New economies demanded a new expansion of finance. Behold, then, the new economy, the new financial system called international capitalism. Soon it arrived at its maturity. Behold it operating in England and her widespread colonies, in the new France and her Asiatic possessions, in modern Germany, which had been welded together by Bismarck, in Belgium, the Netherlands, and in the young, vigorous, vivacious United States. The Industrial Revolution to which I referred was notable for its power machinery, which supplanted the crude tools operated by the human hand. The power machinery, at long last, made mass production possible. At long last, it became possible to supply to the millions of human beings the necessities and many of the conveniences for which they longed. It became possible thanks to Fulton and his steam engine. It became possible thanks to Arkwright and his loom. It became possible thanks to Ampere, to Edison, and to all the scientists in the field of electricity. And most importantly, it became possible thanks to the financial arrangement of capitalism, which extended credit and made loans to the enterprising men who built factories and undertook to supply the demand for which the hungry, needy populations were awaiting. Alas, capitalism, although praiseworthy in many of its original policies, soon adopted the evil practices which are so well known to all of us. It was good for enterprising men to build large factories for the production of life's necessities, but it was evil for them to pay less than living wages to the millions of laborers who worked in those factories. It was good for the rich to invest money in the industries, but it was evil for them to reap the major portion of the profit. It was good for private banking concerns to create credit for the construction of railroads, for the electrification of cities,
for the financing of mammoth projects. But it was evil for them to control that money as they pleased, and for their own profit to the detriment of the teeming mass. It was good for bankers and industrialists to interest themselves in the activities of the state, but it was evil for them to gain control of the state through their kept politicians and loans. Thus, avarice, greed, unemployment, monopolistic concentration of wealth, political domination, unbearable taxes, and wars waged for the commercial control of the markets of the world, these evils, contrary to the Christian teachings and concept of life, these became so identified with capitalism that men in every land began to blame capitalism for all their woes, for their hunger, their nakedness, their needless poverty in the midst of plenty, for their political distress, and for their war. Now pause to reflect on what I said about the various revolutions of the past. Why did men rebel against the ancient order of the Christian church? Because the leaders in the Christian church oftentimes refused to hold fast to Christ and his social doctrine. Why did men rebel against the Bourbons? Because the leaders of Bourbonism refused to practice the social doctrines of Christ. Why did men rebel in Russia, in Italy, in Spain, and Mexico, and in Germany against capitalism? Because the leaders of capitalism were devoid of Christ's spirit, of Christ's doctrine, of Christ's admonition that we should love one another, that we should treat each other as if we were dealing with Christ, that we should not circumvent our fellow man in business. So the story of man's rebellion is repeated in the modern version of man's uprising against the capitalistic economic regime. Let me read for you what Pope Pius XI said about this capitalistic economic regime. He said, "It is a capitalist economic regime that with a worldwide diffusion of industry has penetrated everywhere, particularly since the publication of Leo's Encyclical. It has invaded and pervaded the economic and social sphere, even of those who live outside its ambit, influencing them, and as it were intimately affecting them by its advantages, inconveniences, and vices. When we turn our attention, therefore, to the changes which this capitalistic economic order has undergone since the days of Leo XIII, we have regard to the interests not only of those who live in countries where capital and industry prevail, but of the whole human race as a whole." And he continues, "In the first place, then, it is evident that in our day, not alone is wealth accumulated, but immense power and despotic economic domination are concentrated in the hands of a few, and that those few are frequently not the owners, but only the trustees and directors of invested funds who administer them at their own good pleasure. This power," continues Pius, "becomes particularly irresistible," yet that word irresistible, "becomes particularly irresistible when exercised by those who, because they hold and control money, are able to govern credit and determine its allotments, for that reason supplying, so to speak, the lifeblood to the entire economic body and grasping, as it were, in their hands the very soul of production, so that no one dare breathe against their will." And this accumulation of power, continues His Holiness, "the characteristic note of the modern economic order,
is a natural result of limitless free competition, which permits the survival of those only who are the strongest, which oftentimes means those who fight most relentlessly and who pay least heed to the dictates of conscience. This concentration of power has led to a threefold struggle for domination, concludes this holy in this excerpt. First, there is a struggle for dictatorship in the economic sphere itself. Then the fierce battle to acquire control of the state so that its resources and authority may be abused in the economic struggle. And last, the clash between states themselves. Unquote. So, my friends, I speak to you of the evils of capitalism. But I would impress upon your minds that these evils, as serious as they are, should be traced back to their parent evils, to the evils of trying to get along without God, of trying to succeed without following the pathway of Christ, of trying to keep Christ's principles from the banking house, from the factory, from the school, of trying to keep Christ's teachings outside the labor union, the home, the hearts of the people, and the government. And I speak to you of the consolidation of the forces of communism and Nazism, the Christless forces which now threaten to overwhelm Europe and possibly the world. Is it fair to speculate, asking ourselves the question, would either communism or Nazism have been successful in Europe had our leaders waged a successful moral war against the abuses of capitalism? To my mind, the question is pertinent. And to my mind, the answer is that both these abominations never would have been born had capitalism been purged of its abuses, had capitalism accepted Jesus Christ. Well, the past is past. Now more pertinent questions confront us. What means all this to America? What means all this to civilization? What means all this to Christianity? To America, this means that henceforth, we must treat communism and Nazism alike. Every word spoken by the communists of Union Square or their fellow travelers in the League of Peace and Democracy against Nazism, these words have ricocheted back into the mouths of the speakers. Every demand that they have made against Nazism, that it be boycotted from our shores, that it be accredited no representation by our State Department, these words have been uttered against communism. And to America, therefore, this means that we no longer can be patient with communists and our fellow travelers, that we no longer can be patient with Nazis or the Bundists. To America, this means that if we wish to avoid the catastrophe which has fallen upon Germany and Russia, if we wish to be strong, if we wish to cultivate a contented people, we must face courageously the evils which characterize our own capitalistic system and eradicate them, cost what it may to the millionaires. Our men must be re-employed at an annual living wage. Our homes and farms must be saved from the dead hand of death. Our taxes must be lowered so that our citizens will not be forced to pay tribute of more than $1 billion a year to the private coiners and controllers of money for doing our bookkeeping. Yes. We Americans have a job to perform, a hard job, an unpleasant job, but a necessary job if America hopes to retain its liberties, its republican form of democracy, its freedom of religion, and its constitution. What does all this mean to civilization? It means first that America must hold herself free from foreign entanglement. Have we not learned our lesson that we have no business in recognizing Russia, in boycotting Germany? Have we not experienced experience the wisdom of George Washington's foreign policy? This means that we must have confidence in the Russian people, in the German people, in the Austrian and Polish people, in all the peoples of Europe and Great Britain to take care of themselves. How will they take care of themselves? Oh, sooner or later, Stalin's star and Hitler's star will set. Sooner or later, the Christian people of all these countries will rise up in their justified wrath against the tyrants who have led them into paganistic bondage. Sooner or later, the day of reckoning will dawn upon the plotters against Christ and his liberty, just as it did upon every tyrant in the past. Confidence, therefore, in the good people of Europe, and prayers and sacrifices for them, that they will return to the faith of their fathers, even though many of them will be called upon to choose a martyr's crown. England, France, Belgium, and Netherlands, all European nations have time to set their homes aright. All have time to do as America must do. All have time to turn back to Christ, to adopt Christ's social program, and to unite their forces against the forces of Antichrist. But until they do this, until England and France will accomplish this, we will not send one soldier or one gun to help England or France to sustain their rotten system of international capitalism. Because eventually, international capitalism, if not Christianized, will breed communism or Nazism. My friends, there are many more things that I would care to say to you today. Time does not permit that I proceed for. I could ask of you the questions and answer them. What does all this mean to Christianity? I could tell you, now that Christ's religion has been regarded merely as a personal religion, now that Christ's religion has not been accepted as the only sane social program for the peace and prosperity of the world, by those who have upheld international capitalism, by those whose abuses were responsible for communism and Nazism, it is time for the world to look aloft above the stars and see there the eternal Son of Justice, who says to all of us, "Come to me, ye who are heavily burdened, and I will refresh you. He who is not with me is against me. And seek ye first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all things shall be added unto you." Or we can look into the depths of that red-brown mixture of communism and Nazism and listen to the voice that emanates from those cells, as it says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler, and their justice, and all things else shall be added unto you." My American fellow citizens, Catholic and Protestant and Jew, I appeal to you in the name of the crucified Christ to lift up your hearts and to revive Christianity in this day. God bless you. A copy of both these addresses are yours for the audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.